Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 44th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is When AI Thinks, Humans Feel. I'm joined by Ming-Wei Wong, who along with Roland T. Rust is the co-author of The Feeling Economy, How Artificial Intelligence is Creating the Era of Empathy. The publisher is Palgrave Macmillan. Ming-Wei holds a number of posts. She's a distinguished professor at National Taiwan University, a fellow of the European Marketing Academy, an international research fellow of the Center for Corporate Reputation at the University of Oxford, and a distinguished research fellow of the Center for Excellence in Service, in that case at the University of Maryland. She is also the incoming editor-in-chief of the Journal of Service Research. Welcome to the show, Ming-Wei.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. So let's plunge right in. The Feeling Economy, in brief, what is this book about?
This is the book about the economic impact of artificial intelligence. People may be mistaken because the main title of the book is The Feeling Economy, and people may think that's a self-help book or psychiatry book. It's not. If you are looking for such a book, you are looking at the wrong one. In this book, the book really talk about when AI is a super thinking machine. We all know how good AI is in crunching numbers, in doing the calculation, big data, data analytics. When AI can do all the super thinking tasks, what can human do? Even in my teaching in the classroom, my students, they are all excellent students because NTU is the best university in my country and in the area. Even with my excellent students, they often ask me, Professor, are we still having jobs in the future? Why are we sitting here to get advanced education? It's because people are so concerned. We know that there is a general concern about AI is going to take over all the jobs. And what can we do? Are we just live happily forever without having to do any jobs? Or we are going to live miserably because AI is going to do all the jobs and we have no jobs, no income, and we're just miserably forever. In this book.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
So in this book, we want to emphasize that there are multiple AI intelligences. Yes, currently AI is a super thinking machine, but AI can do more than that, just like humans. Humans is not just you. Some people are the thinking type and some people are the feeling type. You can ask yourself whether you are good at dealing with people or whether you are good at crunching numbers. When humans has multiple intelligences, it means if AI do the thinking, then humans really can concentrate on feeling. Actually, feeling is our human nature. And in the current thinking age, we kind of been trained to be a thinking scientist and try to suppress our feeling nature. So this book concentrates on demonstrating to showing that when AI is so good at thinking, humans should go back to human nature, that is feeling, so that it become a beautiful picture of a complementarity between AI, thinking AI and feeling AI. That is the situation. That is when we have the feeling economy. That's what this book about.
Okay, so the positive way to look at this, and we will have to discuss some of the ramifications that may not always be quite so positive, but that it may liberate us as human beings to go back to what is part of our fundamental nature and celebrate it and make it of use to us, which is our emotional abilities and emotional nature. Since your students raised the issue of employability, I was going to ask this question a bit later, but let me go there now. You may not remember all the particulars, but there was at one point a reference in the book to a study done by CNBC where they had culled government data and concluded there was 27 best future jobs. These are jobs that are going to pay more than $100,000 and that the volume of jobs is going to increase, I believe it was, by at least 10% in the next decade. You mentioned that 21 of those 27 jobs are really a good fit for the feeling economy. If you don't remember exactly what all those 21s were, and I know some were managerial and some were in healthcare, Can you just talk about where those opportunities are in some degree of specificity for the future?
I think the opportunities are actually exist for all jobs, not just a few jobs, because AI is designed to do some tasks, specific tasks. So there are all different, there is always a portfolio of tasks in a given job. For example, like being a professor. I like being a professor, not only I have to do my research, that would be the thinking part. I also have to be able to interact nicely with my students. That's the feeling part. And then very often, we still have to file a report to the university, to my department. That is the administrative job part. Almost all jobs comprise the three components altogether. It's just the proportion is different. Of course, jobs.
Okay, no, that's fair enough.
So our prediction is, of course, if a job has a higher percentage of the feeding component, feeding tests, then the job will be more prosperous in the future. But every job almost has that component. If a job has a low percentage of the feeding tests, then the job really had to transform to emphasize the feeding components more. And I have a very good example. Once I made a presentation on this topic in an Inference conference. Inference is an organization that is really comprised of all the computer geeks. It's purely thinking part. So after the presentation, one audience who is a data analytics approached me and said that he is really, really impressed by the talk because he actually experienced the transition in his job personally. He said in the past 5 to 10 years, even if he is a data analyst, a lot of his job, actually, he spent time on communicating with his colleagues, communicating with his clients, instead of crunching numbers, even compared to 5 or 10 years ago. So he experienced the change already.
Okay. You, staying with this employability and the fact I agree with you utterly that every job has these components. It's just a matter of what maybe where the emphasis is and the degree. You also mentioned three things, reskilling, cross-skilling, and upskilling. Can you distinguish between those for us and maybe explain who they apply to most in the workforce?
Yeah, reskilling means it's mainly for those workers who has basic education. It may be if you graduated a long time ago, it may be a little bit difficult for you to say, oh, you want to get advanced education. So for those who have basic education, if you are in manufacturing sector, then the suggestion is you need to require basic feeding skills so that you can work for the service sector. Because the feeding economy is dominated by the service sector. The feeding economy we consider is a soft service economy. So reskill is to encourage them to acquire basic feeding skill. And upskilling to be a feeding worker is for the feeding worker, unskilled feeding worker. They are a feeding worker already, but they are not a skilled one. And then they can upgrade their feeding skill so that they can become an even better feeding worker. And I have an example about a flight attendant. A flight attendant does not require very advanced education to be one, but they require feeding skill. They need to perform the feeding labor so that they can serve their passengers. But very often these are not very sophisticated, or sometimes we say that's not really genuine. So upskill will be a very good path for them so that they only perform the very routine, superficial emotional labor. They can be really very genuinely empathetic with their passengers. So in that way, both passengers and the passengers can feel more satisfied with their service. So this is upskilling. Upskill their basic feeding skill to the real feeding skill to be empathetic with passengers.
Okay. So, just to give the broader sweep for listeners here. So this is really a powerfully important book. It's talking about how the economy, how our society, how our economic prospects are dependent on a movement that is essentially going from brawn to brains to heart. And as part of that movement, which takes us from the 19th century and the Industrial Revolution into the computer age and now AI that continues to make advances, you talk about going from the physical economy to the thinking economy to the feeling economy. And you also talk about standardization, personalization, and now with the feeling economy, we're going to have relationalization. Can you explain those three terms and what their import is?
Okay. The three terms for standardization, I think that is what, based on our multiple AI intelligence view, we consider there are multiple AI intelligences. So we have mechanical AI, thinking AI, and the feeling AI. Mechanical AI is very good at precision. It's so good at doing this kind of routine, repetitive tasks. And so they can provide, sometimes people over my studio, even they will ask me, if that is mechanical AI, if they are good at doing this kind of repetitive routine jobs, is it AI? Actually, it is. It is designed to be this way, and it's for precision. And it has been applied in the manufacturing sector very, very commonly, because manufacturing very often requires scale benefits, scale economy, and it requires precision and consistent quality. And the mechanical AI is designed for that purpose. And so mechanical AI really can provide standardization benefit. Anything, any output, economic output that requires standardization, they can enjoy that. And you can also see the fast food. Fast food can use mechanical arms to prepare food. That is an example of mechanical AI provides standardization benefit. And thinking AI, the major benefit of thinking AI is you can see the thing AI could do data mining. It can see can discover new patterns from the data. So it's so good for personalization. And Netflix's movie recommendation is the best example. Sure. Without Netflix, we recommend movies for viewers. Nowadays, it's almost impossible for us to choose which movie to see. I believe nobody will request that. I don't want to do personalization. Just give me the list so that I can choose the movie myself. I think it's almost impossible given the number of movies that Netflix has in the database. So personalization is to pick out things for customers, for users, that based on their preference. And that is a major benefit of thinking AI. For feeling AI is really to interact and communicate with users. So it really provides experience benefit. It provides the benefit of establishing relationship with the users. So we can see chatbots, conversational bots are very typical examples. But we often also see that the interaction are not very ideal. It's simply because we don't have real feeling AI yet. Currently, the feeling AI is not very mature. And then luckily, because feeling AI is not very mature, relationalization benefit is in the future. Currently, is human. Is human can do their part better than feeling AI. That's why we are going to have the feeding economy. Otherwise, we don't have any economy because AI can do everything.
Sure. Now, there's a special chapter in this book called The Era of Women, and I confess to being a lifelong feminist. So one of the things I really liked about this book was also saying this is a real opportunity, whereas the old economy with brawn was quite possibly the male province, and then thinking was often drawing on men's perhaps slightly superior spatial abilities. But when you come to the feeling era, women have the advantage given their empathy and interpersonal skills quite often, just on average. So can you talk to us about why and how this is going to be of such benefit to women? And I'm also interested in your experiences as a female professional in what I'll call the dwindling days of the thinking economy and how that makes you eager for the feeling economy.
Yeah, I love this question. I'm personally a feeling person, and I'm trained to be a scientist. And I even specifically choose information management as my area because I don't want people to think I'm a female professor so that I can only do emotions. Even if I'm actually interested in that, I'm good at that because I can feel it. I'm a feeling person, so I really can feel the nuance of emotions. But I train myself. And a lot of female professionals actually really train themselves to be a thinking machine as men so that they can compete. They compete in many industries, many jobs with males. And that actually puts females in a disadvantageous position artificially. So in the feeding economy, the situation will be changed. It is males that is going to be, they are going to be in a disadvantageous position because how can male be as thinking capable as thinking AI? There's no way. We can see all the examples. Computer can play chess, AI can play chess better than humans, can world play better than world champions, play Go, play a lot of games. So if you want to compete with AI in terms of thinking capability, this is a losing game. And traditionally, males are better in thinking and they are in an advantageous position. So in the feeding economy, when AI is so good at thinking, that really, I don't have to use myself as an example. I don't have to really just force myself to be a thinking machine. I can leverage my advantage of I'm more empathetic than a lot of male colleagues. I believe they won't hear this interview. And a lot of males really just don't have empathetic capability. And so that really gives female a chance to complement with thinking AI. Thinking AI does the thinking and the females can do the feeding. And that's why we predict that in the feeding economy, they will give females a fairer opportunity in the economy. And actually our recent empirical evidence really supports our prediction that females actually have a better chance to participate in the economy because of the advance of thinking AI.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Okay, now in the book, if I remember right, the feeling economy you thought would be the dominant mode by about 2036, something in that kind of range. I'm curious, you also say that yes, as AI gets better and better, it's going to be able to compete at least to a reasonable degree in the feeling space. It may not surpass human beings for some time, maybe mid-century. I don't know if you put a date to that. But there's another book I wanted to bring into this conversation. I imagine you might have read it or at least heard about it. It's The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff. And it raises concerns about privacy issues. And I know that's part of the book. And if you don't know the book at all, I can give a bit of a thumbnail summary of it. But it's really the privacy issue that she's concerned about. And large companies, Facebook and others, essentially leveraging, capitalizing on people's personal data. And all of us as consumers, as citizens, losing agency over our private information and losing our privacy. Any concerns? How does that interact with play off of the AI revolution and what I and you both hope are some really nice advantages for the feeling economy?
For the privacy issue, it is so hard. Even now, Facebook and Apple are in fight because of privacy issue. Remember that when we say that thinking, the major benefit of thinking AI is to provide personalization benefit. And the personalization benefits all depends on the data. If the users are not willing to provide their data, their preference data to show what they like, what they don't like, then there's no way personalization can do a good job. And I think that is also the trade-off between data and the personalization is a privacy and the personalization is also the key argument between Apple and Facebook. And I want to provide an, I don't want to rule out the possibility, but I want to provide an alternative view. That is for example, like I mentioned that male tend now, that tend to have lower empathetic capability. A lot of male, they do not aware. They do not, it's difficult for them to know. They even do not aware their own emotions or how to manage their own emotions, not to mention to understand other people's emotions. I think they cause a lot of marriage problem already.
Yes.
And so the advance, I think that this data, when we say the data is not, especially on Facebook, you can see a lot of data or on the internet, a lot of data is emotional data. It's about how consumers feel, what they like, what they don't like. And then that kind of data, actually, if used in the right way, also can help users to understand their own emotions. A lot of applications we call affective analytics have really actually used the analytical, use thinking AI to analyze feeling data to help consumers to maintain a better relationship, maintain a better personal relationship, living quality, and help them to understand their own emotions. That has been used quite widely in psychology. In psychology and for relation benefit already. So that is the benefit that I think I would like to highlight that it's always a trade-off between privacy and the personalization. It depends on to what degree you are willing to give up privacy, or I would not say give up privacy, to what degree you're willing to trust. You are willing to trust the vendors or the institutions that provide personalization benefits so that you'll be more open up. Because actually that's true. Personalization depends on the accuracy of the data.
Sure. And then relationalization is going to depend on indeed that trust that you just mentioned and the fact that the consumer is willing to allow for that privacy because there's something in it for them as well. So maybe that's part of the path forward here. I do remember some years ago, there was an article, I think it was in Financial Times, and I read it mid-flight, saying that Google was kind of like the last of the, almost not these terms, because I hadn't read your book yet, but the thinking economy, and Facebook was the harbinger of the feeling economy. I bring this up because of the Internet of Things. Where do you think the Internet of Things is going to take us in terms of the feeling economy and then the advances and encroachments of AI?
Internet of Things is mainly the mechanical. In our categorization, is the mechanical AI.
Okay.
And so its major benefit, I think, I'm very happy to hear that you bring this topic when we talk about feeling economy, because actually it serves as the backbone. It connects, when we discuss the privacy issue, because the Internet thing actually connects every dot and every person, every object together. So without Internet thing, the data is not going to flow between different dots. So when individuals and are all connected together and the objects are all connected together, actually it really make a data be more available for personalization. That's the positive side. And of course, also make the users in the higher risk of privacy issue, a privacy problem. So that will be, it's double-edged. So we discussed that it's the backbone, Internet thing, it's the backbone, and it's the mechanical AI that comes to the backbone of thinking AI and the feeling AI, because it collects data and make a data flow in the network so that we can decide whether we want to share, to what degree we want to use. And those are a lot of issues, but without the backbone, there's no data there.
Sure. So this is all fascinating stuff. There's a few more places I want to get to because this book has a lot of reach. And just in a few minutes, if we can maybe touch on each of these, I particularly want to go to education reform. In part, I just spoke to someone this morning who's in that sector and said, oh my God, they are 10 years behind where things are at. They're not even practically at the doorstep in many cases of understanding that the feeling economy is upon us, that they're still thinking very much about hard skills and training in terms of thinking analysis, but EQ is hardly in the curriculum whatsoever. What are your thoughts about where, from your vantage point, where we're at in terms of education and education reform, and how are we going to get this out there so that it's beyond just the purview of the psychology department alone, for instance?
Yeah, there are two issues I can comment on. The first one is, I think nowadays data analytics program is booming almost in all universities. Every university is striving to provide data analytics program. That is really in the wrong direction, because data analytics, that is so straightforward thinking AI can do. And the humans just really cannot all be thinking AI and become a super data analyst. And we also see that in a lot of, especially in the US, in a lot of programs, we see Americans cannot compete with international students on this. And it turned out to be it's very imbalanced in the university, in the classroom, that for data analysis is full of international students based on their strong STEM training in their own culture. And I would not say they are happy. A lot of students in my program, the information management, which is part of STEM education and is very popular because it's very good, it's very easy to find a job. But it's data crunching. It's thinking training. We train students to be a thinking machine. A lot of students really drop out or are very unhappy because they major because of the future, the easier to find a job, or because parents want them to do it. And that is so wrong. So we really need to, I think it's not just for finding a job, but it's also for well-being. We really need to provide students with EQ training, not STEM, not just STEM education. That is very essential. And the second part I would like to comment is about the whether emotional intelligence is trainable. I think a lot of people may have a concern about whether it's trainable because it seems it's more natural. You come with it or you don't have it. And we are not so sure to what degree that is true. But if we don't begin to provide more balanced education, we never know. Because even if it's not 100% trainable, if we can provide students with better emotional skill, even if it does not benefit to their career, it definitely will benefit to make them be a better human being.
Well, in fact, I think it will benefit their career. Having been in academia with a PhD myself, I know that the classroom doesn't always manage to get to the interactive skills as much as it could. And certainly in the business world, I just the other day read an article that hard skills are only about 11% of the reason why people fail at a job. The rest largely comes down to personality, emotional intelligence, emotional discipline, interactive skills, empathy, so many of the things that you're championing in this book in relation to the feeling economy. Just one of the places I wanted to go to, and you could take on either or both of these. One is this book really goes broad to talk about also the fact that the feeling economy is giving us a different version of the media in terms of Rush Limbaugh, who just passed away, Fox News, different candidates from Donald Trump to Bernie Sanders, who are highly emotive in their style, and even in the arts and creativity and how AI is going to interact. So that's my last question, essentially take it where you'd like to, but there's a lot of trend lines here that are fascinating to pursue and have a lot of implication for our society, particularly obviously in terms of the political leaders who take us forward.
Do you mean the political leaders, emotional, political leaders' EQ?
Yes. I mean, the book does mention everything from Boris Johnson to Donald Trump to Joe Biden. I mean, are we indeed going to be seeing a version of politician who, Donald Trump's considerable number of misstatements or I'm not sure. I guess I want to just call them flat out lies, quite honestly, but not so much anchored in facts analytically as emoting strongly, but that having a lot of appeal for voters often. Do you think that with AI, not only are we going to get a more feeling economy, are we destined to keep having feeling politicians? Is that the future that you and your co-author project?
I think I can use Trump and Biden as the pair of example.
Okay.
And so I think Biden's campaign, political campaign, even now, I think he's really play empathy heavily. In all his talks about the COVID or in his also talking during his campaign, he emphasized, he's really just softened his tone and emphasized empathy. And sometimes during his campaign, people were thinking about he was too soft. But actually, that's his campaign. His main thing is empathy, and he wants to bring the empathy into the campaign instead of just being negative. And if I compare Biden's campaign with Hillary's campaign, you can see Hillary is more like a thinking type. It's more like he asks people to think correct, to be more analytical about things, about fact. And then you can see people did not really buy it. But the interesting thing is most of the politicians, including the pair between Biden and Trump, they all play emotions. But it all depends, it's just based on whether you play emotions in a positive way, genuine way, or not. And the emotion, when we say the feeling economy, in the feeling economy, empathy is the key thing. We mean genuine empathy.
Yeah.
We don't mean just you play people's emotion. I think that is a key distinction. And that is also why in the subtitle of the book, we emphasize empathy. It means genuine empathy. Empathy is to understand other people's emotion is different from play people's emotion.
Yeah, no, I certainly, even though the words are not in the book with any frequency, authenticity and trust seem to me certainly part of the equation here with the feeling economy. So Ming Wei, I want to thank you so much. Our time is about up. Thank you for being my guest here on Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. This has been episode number 44, When AI Thinks, Humans Feel. My guest has been Ming Wei Wang, the co-author of The Feeling Economy, How Artificial Intelligence is Creating the Era of Empathy. If you've enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. To check out other episodes, you can go to my company's website at the obligatory 3 W's and sensorylogic.com, or go to the New Books Network website where the podcast appears under its special series programming. Finally, I'd like to conclude every episode with an appropriate epigram. In this case, I would like to quote from a character, Gigolo Joe, in Steven Spielberg's 2001 movie, AI, Artificial Intelligence. And the character says at one point, "Man made us better at what we do than was ever humanly possible." So think about that. Until next time, be kind and stay safe.